Chapter 6. The Syrian Wars. Within a few months of bin Laden's demise, the Arab world had changed utterly. The governments of Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya had fallen. That of Yemen was teetering on the brink. And the Assad regime in Syria was locked in an increasingly bitter struggle for survival. By the close of 2011, the arc of unrest stretched from Morocco to Iran. Across the region and beyond, the protests engendered a sense of hope. Citizens of the Arab Spring nations began to feel more empowered than they had in decades. Capturing the mood of the moment, an Al Jazeera commentator said, "Now the Arabs have found their voice and are out in their millions in the streets in the Arab world." So in a sense, the whole idea of Al-Qaeda, even if it had any merits in the eyes of very few, it simply has absolutely no role in today's Arab world. Zawahiri and others like him reject such optimism. On an ideological level, those who preach the Al-Qaeda brand of Salafist extremism despise genuine representative government as little better than a form of polytheism, putting the law of men above that of God. More importantly still, hope represents an existential threat to their movement. Feelings of personal empowerment can act as a powerful antidote to all the toxins of despair, grievance, and humiliation that poison the minds of disillusioned young men and propel them toward lives of terrorism. In the face of the Arab Spring, with its peaceful shift from despondency and despotism to democracy and aspiration, it seemed that groups such as Al-Qaeda, which trumpet nihilistic violence as the only viable path to dignity and self-determination, risked obsolescence and decline. But Ayman al-Zawahiri, ever the attentive student, knew his history too well to believe for one moment that the Arab Spring would give birth to a democratic Middle East. As he was well aware, the Arab world had seen it all before. In the 1950s, millions of people had taken to the streets in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and beyond, denouncing the existing regimes and calling for change. In Jordan, revolutionaries forced the king to give up significant power to a pan-Arabist prime minister, while in Lebanon, the situation became so volatile that President Eisenhower dispatched U.S. Marines to stabilize the country. In the wake of the general upheaval, autocratic regimes came to power in Iraq, Egypt, and Tunisia. When asked about his country's political system, Tunisia's new ruler, Habib Bourguiba, channeled Louis XIV, quipping, "I am the system." Barely three decades later, during the 1980s, protests once again erupted in the Arab world. Again, they went viral. Riots swept across Egypt, Jordan, Yemen, and Morocco. Algeria descended into the abyss of civil war. Sudan's president was toppled by a military coup. Tunisia's was overthrown by a slick former soldier and diplomat, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who came to power promising democratic reforms. This was the same Ben Ali whose widespread and barely concealed theft from his own people would ignite the Arab Spring and see him in his turn deposed by new leaders. It remains to be seen whether this time the democratic dream will be fulfilled. The plain truth is that mass protests in North Africa and the Middle East are common enough, and when they occur, they are likely to spread to neighboring countries with the same language and religion and similar histories and cultures. Decades before the first tweet or Facebook post, Gamal Abdel Nasser was using the power of radio to foster pan-Arab sentiment. Even in 2011, Qatar used the 30-year-old phenomenon of cable news, in the guise of the Al Jazeera network, to ensure blanket coverage of the Arab Spring and the escalating violence in Syria. Whatever the year and whatever the medium, the Arab world's tribal patriarchies, with zero history of liberalism, let alone participatory democracy, are simply not going to become Madisonian utopias anytime soon. Arab leaders, many of them, like Ben Ali and Assad, partly educated in the West, have rarely shown even the smallest appetite for surrendering power once they have a hold on it. Instead, one corrupt autocrat is replaced, often bloodily, by another corrupt autocrat. And whether they arrive in office sporting a general's epaulettes, a cleric's robe, or a lawyer's pinstripes, these men soon take on the trappings of dictatorship. Meet the new boss, as Pete Townsend wrote, same as the old boss. Bin Laden sought to break the never-ending cycle from one corrupt autocrat to the next by creating chaos. Freedom is not achieved without a heavy price, he wrote in reference to the Arab Spring, and blood is a component that cannot be separated from the other components to achieve it. Exposing the people of the Islamic nation to death is a very difficult matter, but there is no other way to save them. No other way. The genius of Al-Qaeda's plan lies in its recognition that, in an important sense, dictators like Tunisia's Bourguiba, who claimed they were the system, had been right all along. Take away the pharaoh without immediately replacing him with another strongman, and the whole polity fractures along atavistic lines into its component sects, tribes, and so on. What follows is not liberal democracy, but chaos, bloodshed, and broken dreams. Al-Qaeda has long recognized that such societal collapse, savagery in jihadi jargon, is an indispensable part of strategy. The most critical phase through which the Ummah will pass, as the subtitle to The Management of Savagery puts it, this worldview sees violence and political turmoil as the wrecking balls necessary to smash the institutions of central government and clear the way for fundamentalist rule. Those jihadists who adhered to this basic playbook, from Bin Laden in his high-walled mansion in Abbottabad and Zawahiri in his South Asian hideout, to the Islamic State of Iraq in its desert foxholes, therefore heard in the tumult of the Arab Spring not a death knell, but a call to action. Properly exploited, they realized, the uprisings would leave behind a void, much like the vacuums described in The Management of Savagery, ready to be filled with extremist ideology. When the dictators were gone, for good this time, their pompous nationalism would evaporate, the phony colonialist nation-states would crumble, and religion would once again be the one unifying factor, just as in the storied days of the original Rashidun Caliphate. Reality, of course, would conform neither to the democratic nor the jihadist vision. Some Arab Spring revolutions, like those of Bahrain, Algeria, and Saudi Arabia, would simply fizzle out without changing much. Egypt would follow the established pattern and exchange one autocrat for another. In Syria, Libya, and Yemen, however, Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups would indeed manage to manipulate the uprisings to create upheaval and grab territory. And in each case, they would be assisted, wittingly or unwittingly, directly or indirectly, by foreign powers eager for influence. Nowhere has this pattern been more evident than in Syria. For Zawahiri and the Islamic State of Iraq, Syria's precipitous descent from relative urbanity to abject barbarism helped create the greatest bonanza of the whole Arab Spring. An arc of state failure across northern Iraq and Syria, ripe for jihadi exploitation, precisely in line with the course outlined in The Management of Savagery. The ensuing war can seem like a confusing tangle of militias and terrorist groups, with agendas now parallel, now competing. But as with an old master painting in a museum, take a step back, and the chaos of tiny brushstrokes begins to resolve itself into a more meaningful picture. With sufficient distance, we begin to see a remarkably traditional set of interests driving the conflict. Those of nation-states with regional and global axes to grind. Clearly, Al-Qaeda and its panoply of peers are by no means the only actors seeking advantage in Syria's misfortune. When I was a school kid growing up in Lebanon, I was taught that every sect, every political group, every minute subdivision of my country's intricately variegated gene pool was somehow in thrall to some international power. In the mistrustful Middle East, this kind of thinking is hardly unique. But in Lebanon, we raised such theories to an art form. The Sunnis? No question. The Ottoman Turks were their masters. The Maronites took orders from the French. The Druze from the British. The Orthodox answered to Moscow, and the Shia to Tehran. So it went, all the way down the line. Every gradation belonged to someone. And this was no mere street corner speculation or tea house gossip. This was written down in newspapers and school history textbooks, and thus ratified in the permanency of print. One more example of the crazed conspiracy obsessions that bedevil every country in the Arab world. And yet, there was an essential kernel of truth to what we were taught in our history classes. True, the alliances we learned about were nowhere near so firm as we were given to believe. But on the geopolitical stage, you are nobody until you have at least one dog in the perpetual melee that is the Middle East. The Syrian civil war is a particularly ugly example of this phenomenon. It is a conflict in whose outcome myriad powers hold equity, both within the region and beyond: Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Russia, China, the United States, Europe, and on and on. Most of those doing the fighting and dying in Syria are essentially little more than pawns. Assad's most effective defenders have little personal attachment or emotional commitment to him, and those who oppose him do not do so out of any deep-seated personal animus. Whether they know it or not, they fight on behalf of the interests in the shadows that have chosen to move them to this particular place at this particular time, in the pursuit of goals having little to do with local concerns. As is often the case, the people actually waging the war, like those suffering its consequences, are the ones with the least to gain. With only U.S. media coverage as a guide, one could be forgiven for thinking that, aside from the Assad regime itself, the Islamic State is the only game that matters in Syria. Nothing could be further from the truth. On the contrary, the Islamic State is merely the largest and most brutal of a bewildering array of opposition groups, with agendas that seem to clash more than they overlap. Indeed, from a jihadist's point of view, the history of the Syrian conflict has been at least as much about rival groups fighting each other as it has been about any of them battling Assad or the secular opposition. In 2013, faced with a simmering dispute between Jabhat al-Nusra and the newly renamed Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, then nominally al-Qaeda's franchises in Syria and Iraq, respectively, Ayman al-Zawahiri appointed a personal representative in the hopes of breaking the logjam. The man he chose, Abu Khalid al-Suri, belonged neither to al-Nusra nor to ISIL, but to a third group, Ahrar al-Sham. Yet Abu Khalid's ties to al-Qaeda stretched back almost to the organization's founding. As his toponym suggests, Abu Khaled al-Suri was Syrian. He was born Muhammad Bahaya in Aleppo in 1963, the year Assad's Syrian Ba'ath Party seized power in a coup d'etat. As a young man, he became a close associate of Abu Musab al-Suri, who would go on to pen the influential tract The Call of the Global Islamic Resistance, in which he called Abu Khalid my brother and friend, my companion throughout my life. As members of the Fighting Vanguard, a militant splinter of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, both men fought in the uprisings against Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father and predecessor, that took place during the late 1970s and early 1980s. That unrest culminated in 1982 in Hama, a city on the main highway between Damascus and Aleppo. In an effort to reassert control, 12,000 regime troops laid siege to rebels holed up in Hama. Between 10,000 and 40,000 people reportedly died in the fighting. One survivor recalled having to step over corpses in the streets, and many more were abducted, imprisoned, or tortured in the reprisals that followed. The regime's terror tactics worked. Hama would prove to be the last major uprising in Syria until the Arab Spring, nearly 30 years later, by which time a different Assad would be in control. To anyone familiar with images of the current violence in Syria, The pictures of Hamas' burned-out buildings and ash-strewn streets look disturbingly familiar. As one Syrian activist's tweet mordantly declared, Homs 2011 equals Hama 1982. But slowly, slowly. Like many Syrian jihadis who survived the devastation of Hama, Abu Khalid quickly fled the country. By the early 1990s, he had found a place in Afghanistan, where he helped run media operations for various jihadi groups, met Ayman al-Zawahiri for the first time, and attended al-Qaeda's infamous Farouk training camp, then under the leadership of a contemporary of Abu Khalid's, the young Saif al-Adl. Later, Abu Khalid relocated to Spain and became bin Laden's chief courier in Europe. In 1997, around the time KSM was pushing his planes operation, an employee of Abu Khalid's brother-in-law made surveillance tapes of the World Trade Center and other U.S. landmarks. The following year, Abu Khalid ferried the tapes to bin Laden in Afghanistan. By September 11, 2001, Abu Khalid had become an important al-Qaeda fixer, helping to arrange funding and logistics for a number of plots, including the 9/11 attacks themselves. Following 9/11, according to some reports, Abu Khalid fought U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. At any rate, he appears to have been apprehended in Pakistan in 2005 and transferred first to CIA custody, then to Syria, where he was interned at Sednaya, a prison in the mountains north of Damascus known for its population of political and jihadi inmates. Abu Khalid thus became a member of the Sednaya Generation, a group of influential jihadis who came together behind bars, much as imprisonment at the U.S. facility Camp Buka brought together the hodgepodge of religious militants and Saddam loyalists who would go on to lead the Islamic State. Many of Abu Khalid's contemporaries at Sednaya have played outsized roles in the Syrian conflict. One, Abu Athir al-Absi, became the Islamic State governor of Aleppo province and mentored Muhammad Emwazi, the British executioner, more commonly known as Jihadi John. And members of the cells that attacked Paris in November 2015 and Brussels in March 2016. It goes without saying that men of the Sednaya generation like Abu Athir and Abu Khalid pose a significant threat to secular Arab regimes like that of Bashar al-Assad. Yet in 2011, with the rebellion against his rule boiling over into civil war, Assad voluntarily released these two men and many others like them. This may seem puzzling, even paradoxical, but it was all part of a conscious strategy on Assad's part, one that had served him well in the past. Bashar al-Assad was never meant to be president. Since childhood, his older brother Basel had been groomed for the role. As a cavalry major in the Syrian army, a gifted horseman, and the head of his father Hafez Assad's personal security detail, Basel cut a figure around Damascus, where his photograph, dark aviator sunglasses, neat black beard, red army beret, stared confidently from shop walls and car windows. Meanwhile, Hafez's younger son was left largely to his own devices. Bashar trained in medicine, became an ophthalmologist, and furthered his studies for a while in London. In January 1994, however, Basel was killed when he crashed his car at high speed on the way to Damascus Airport in heavy fog. Bashar, suddenly the heir apparent, was called back to Syria, rebranded as a military officer, and swiftly elevated to the rank of colonel in the armored corps. When the old dictator himself died 6 years later in June 2000, it was Bashar who took up the reins of power, touting himself as a reformer. But despite his youth, his time abroad, and his glamorous Syrian-British wife, a Sunni, unlike the Alawite Assad family, Bashar's regime produced no meaningful changes. It announced hundreds of pieces of modernizing legislation, but never followed up with implementation orders. It made no effort to reform Syria's antiquated court system, leaving most legal matters to a minority-dominated bureaucracy, nor was there any palpable attempt at political reform. Instead, like his father before him, Bashar al-Assad kept political, administrative, economic, and military power concentrated within his own extended family. Corruption skyrocketed, even as human development flatlined, as part of a campaign of economic modernization. Assad cut subsidies to rural areas, historically the heartland of Ba'athist support. Not coincidentally, these same areas would later become hotbeds of opposition to Assad during the Arab Spring. Even before the civil war, almost the only countries willing to risk money in Syria were its political allies, especially Iran, and the Islamic Republic's motives often had less to do with economic investment than with currying influence in a strategically significant region. Bashar had been in power for little more than a year when al-Qaeda terrorists crashed their stolen planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Syria had no direct connection to the attacks. But in their immediate aftermath, Assad became alarmed at the sweeping anti-terror powers the Bush administration was able to amass and act upon. Less than 2 weeks after the fall of the Twin Towers, the United States had procured Security Council Resolution 1373, which obliged every country in the world to cooperate to defeat terrorism. Assad's vice president expressed the fear that 1373 was in reality an international emergency law that will limit countries' sovereignty and place them under the Security Council's tutelage, thus paving the way for a conflict of civilizations instead of dialogue. This was an ironic enough statement, one might think, coming from a regime that had itself governed under an official state of emergency for over 30 years. But it reflected Assad's trepidation in the face of this new peak of American power. Initially, hoping to placate the United States, during one of its strongest moments on the international stage, Assad cooperated with the Bush administration, helping the CIA to round up and interrogate terrorist suspects. But if the United States appreciated this assistance, it chose a strange way of showing its gratitude. In May 2002, Under Secretary of State John R. Bolton publicly added Syria to President Bush's ill-conceived Axis of Evil list, citing its chemical and biological warfare program. By then, it had already become clear that the Bush administration's overall policy in the region was to carry out, as one well-placed analyst put it, an overhaul of the Arab and Islamic world rather than dealing with it as it is. The centerpiece of the remodeling effort was, of course, to be an invasion of Syria's neighbor and fellow Ba'athist state, Iraq. Saddam and the Assads had ended diplomatic ties after Syria joined the coalition to end Iraq's occupation of Kuwait in 1991 and had not restored them since. But the Syrian tyrant realized that once his Iraqi counterpart was gone, he might well be next on America's hit list. So Assad resolved to make life as difficult as possible for the Americans in order to eject them from the region before they could press on to Damascus. Hence Assad's assistance to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and others in setting up a corridor through Syria for jihadi recruits heading for Iraq. Hence also, after a decade of hostility, his regime's sudden overtures to Saddam. Immediately before the 2003 U.S. invasion, Syria's prime minister traveled to Baghdad, where he presented the Iraqi president with a ceremonial sword and reportedly told him that Assad would consider any invasion of Iraq an attack against Syria. Assad also reached out to Syria's long-standing ally Iran. Just days before shock and awe hit Baghdad, he traveled in person to Tehran for a meeting with Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. According to leaked minutes of that meeting, Assad told Khamenei, "We are the only leaders in the region who are masters of their own fate, as you are well aware, and we believe the best course of action for us is to draw out the war to exhaust the Americans and push them deeper into the Iraqi quagmire. And while it's true that the people of Iraq are not fond of Saddam Hussein, they will not tolerate a U.S. occupation of their territory. Therefore, we are all but certain that resistance will erupt against the occupation, and we need to coordinate before war breaks out. We must thwart U.S. efforts in Iraq and if we cannot defeat the Americans, then we need to ensure the situation remains volatile and suicide operations carry on unabated. After all, the thing that frightens Americans the most is telling them their sons will be killed in Iraq. Despite the shocking scale and speed of Saddam's collapse, Assad's strategy ultimately prevailed, at least in the medium term. As Assad had predicted, the U.S. public proved unwilling to absorb a flood of body bags, especially from a conflict whose raison d'etre many Americans perceived as paper thin. In 2008, after half a decade of bloodshed, the United States elected a new president on a platform of ending the war post-haste, something that Obama eventually did 3 years later. Bashar al-Assad, however, was not done pouring gasoline on the fires of jihadism. When the revolt against his rule broke out in 2011, protesters clamored for the release of political prisoners. Assad saw in this demand an opportunity both to quell immediate criticism and undermine the legitimacy of the revolution. In May and June 2011, he issued an amnesty for dangerous jihadis, including many members of the Sednaya generation, among them Abu Khalid al-Suri, hoping that they would hijack the uprising in the name of jihad and thus give Assad a palatable excuse for crushing the opposition. Abu Khalid's post-Sednaya activities seemed to confirm Assad's thinking. Within a few months of their release, Abu Khalid and a group of fellow Sednaya alumni had confounded a new militant group, Ahrar al-Sham, Freemen of the Levant. The name was intended to burnish the group's credentials as legitimate local freedom fighters. They were not to be seen as foreign jihadi extremists. In many ways, Abu Khalid's group had come to embody the complexities of the Syrian conflict. On the one hand, Ahrar's goals were unabashedly Islamist. Indeed, they explicitly include bringing Syria under fundamentalist rule. While Ahrar does not always agree with the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, indeed the two groups have sometimes come to violent blows, more often than not, Ahrar's agenda aligns with that of al-Nusra, and the two factions' militants frequently fight alongside one another against Assad's forces. On the other hand, Ahrar has explicitly rejected the sectarianism and brutality espoused by some of its rivals. It has also disavowed any international agenda, unlike al-Qaeda, which sees America as the main enemy, and has gone out of its way to distance itself from al-Qaeda Central. Despite his seniority and his centrality to the group's creation, Khalid al-Suri was never made emir of Ahrar al-Sham, partly, no doubt, because of the negative publicity he would bring as someone who had once been close to bin Laden. Instead, the top job went initially to another Sednaya alumnus, Hassan Aboud. By 2013, Aboud, Abu Khalid, and their colleagues had built Ahrar al-Sham into one of the most effective militias fighting Assad, and with perhaps 20,000 members, one of the largest, behind only al-Nusra and the Islamic State. Together with a rotating cast of allied groups, Ahrar has made broad territorial gains in the northwestern provinces of Idlib and Latakia, in the process defeating and stripping weapons from Free Syrian Army groups, including at least one backed by the United States. Apparently conscious of the popular antipathy that helped bring down the first Iraqi insurgency shortly after Zarqawi's death, Ahrar has held back from imposing its harsh conception of Sharia right away. Instead, it has tried to maintain public support in the region under its control by feeding its inhabitants, supplying them with fuel, and rebuilding roads, bridges, and water pumps. For much the same reason, the group's official communications repeatedly emphasize its ideological differences with al-Qaeda, especially its avowed rejection of global jihad in favor of a focus on Syria alone. In contrast to the naked sectarianism peddled by the heirs of Zarqawi, Abu Khalid's group has mostly shied away from discriminatory rhetoric and has even promised to allow members of religious minorities to hold posts in any future government it may form. In late 2013 or early 2014, asked about the group's ties to al-Qaeda, a spokesman said, "There is neither a secret nor a public link," emphasizing that Ahrar al-Sham included no one who belongs to al-Qaeda. This was disingenuous at best, since at the time Ahrar was at the height of its cooperation with al-Nusra. Moreover, the statement was made while Abu Khalid was serving as Zawahiri's personal representative in Syria, in which capacity he was not only attempting to resolve disputes in Khorasan's favor, but also siphoning off donations to the Syrian opposition from wealthy Gulf donors and redirecting the funds to Al-Qaeda Central. "He was to me and my brothers such a great advisor," Zawahiri said of Abu Khalid in this period. However, as bin Laden himself had been acutely aware, there was mileage in disavowing any connection with Al-Qaeda, especially for a group interested in attracting aid from foreign governments and in nurturing goodwill among locals with a view to future participation in politics. This approach has paid off for Ahrar al-Sham, as more secular-minded projects like the Free Syrian Army have seemed to run out of steam. Western allies in the region, such as Saudi Arabia and Turkey, have increasingly come to rely on relatively moderate Islamist groups like Ahrar as a means of carrying on the fight against Assad. But these countries' motivations go much deeper than the elimination of a regional rival. Prince Mohammed bin Naif, Saudi Arabia's crown prince and interior minister, knows the dangers of terrorism firsthand, having survived at least three assassination attempts. In the closest of these attacks, in August 2009, an al-Qaeda militant detonated a concealed suicide bomb at a reception in the prince's home. The explosion tore the bomber apart. Footage of the aftermath showed the walls, floor, and ceiling spattered with blood and body parts. But bin Naif astonishingly escaped with only minor wounds and was discharged from the hospital the same day. Experiences like this helped forge in bin Naif a determination to reverse his government's long-standing policy of tolerance toward the thousands of young Saudi men who have been traveling abroad for jihad ever since the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. For bin Naif, the Syrian conflict has made plain the dangers inherent in such a policy. The roughly 2,500 Saudis fighting for extremist groups in Syria make them the second most prevalent nationality among Sunni foreign fighters, after Tunisians. And the Saudi combatants are known for being peculiarly zealous, a trait that shows in their disproportionate propensity to volunteer as suicide bombers. Someday, these radicals will return, and many will still have murder in mind. It is even possible that the Islamic State's so-called caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, may seek to make good his improbable claim to be the leader of all the world's Muslims by seizing the two holiest places in Islam, Mecca and Medina, both of which are in Saudi Arabia. Indeed, in July 2016, Islamic State suicide bombers struck the Prophet's mosque in Medina, hoping to damage the legitimacy of the Saudi regime as custodian of the holy sites. But even that threat pales in comparison to the danger posed by radicalized young men who choose to stay at home. Tight-knit local cells are already pursuing a terror campaign across the kingdom that has featured assassinations of police and suicide bombings of mosques. These men are more difficult to detect than fighters abroad, precisely because they do not cross international borders and do not need to communicate electronically over long distances. Bin Naif's influence on high-level decision-making in the kingdom signals a shift away from those Saudi figures who preach radicalism. He engineered a major reshuffling of the former king's closest advisors, including the removal of several foreign policy hawks from his inner circle, among them Prince Bandar bin Sultan, a former ambassador to the United States and the ex-deputy minister of defense. Under bin Naif's guidance, in February 2014, the late King Abdullah issued a royal decree forbidding Saudi involvement in extremist groups and participation in foreign wars, including those raging in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. The following month, Saudi Arabia designated ISI and the al-Qaeda franchise al-Nusra as terrorist organizations, which had the effect of formally outlawing donations and assistance to those groups. Shortly after taking office at the beginning of 2015, the new king, Salman bin Abdulaziz, made bin Nayef first in line to the throne, in addition to his position as interior minister. But bin Nayef's influence is far from absolute. The crown prince must compete for attention with the man who stands to inherit the throne after him, King Salman's own son, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. In his early 30s, bin Salman is a generation younger than bin Nayef, but he holds similarly powerful offices, serving as deputy crown prince and defense minister. President Obama has called the millennial prince wise beyond his years, but in private, other commentators more commonly accuse him of impulsiveness, arrogance, and naivete. In contrast to bin Nayef's caution, bin Salman has urged a more interventionist policy towards Syria. The kingdom has stepped up supplies of American-made TOW anti-tank missiles to moderate Free Syrian Army groups. This support has been credited with halting government gains in the strategic Hab Valley, southwest of Idlib. But not all recipients of bin Salman's assistance have been as benign. In 2015, Saudi Arabia helped create, fund, and arm the Army of Conquest, the coalition of militant groups of which Abu Khalid's organization, Ahrar al-Sham, is a leading member, as is the al-Qaeda franchise al-Nusra and its successor organization, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. Bin Salman is thought to be the architect of both these initiatives. In February 2016, he appeared to go further, speaking publicly about contributing ground forces to fight the Islamic State. But this announcement forced a swift clarification from the Saudi government to the effect that the kingdom would only offer a largely symbolic contingent of special forces, and even then, only as part of a future American-led ground intervention, a prospect that seems remote, to say the least. The influence of bin Salman has greatly contributed to what German intelligence has publicly called an impulsive policy of intervention in Syria, as well as in Yemen, where Saudi forces face a quagmire largely of the kingdom's own making. In both cases, the goal has been to stave off the one terrible vision that looms over all Saudi policymaking, an ascendant Iran at the jeweled hilt of a vast Shia scimitar, slicing through the Middle East from the Arabian Sea to the Eastern Mediterranean. With a Shia-dominated government in Baghdad, a resurgent Hezbollah in Lebanon, and an Iranian client clinging to power in Damascus, this nightmare seems closer than ever to reality. This makes the Syrian issue an existential one for the House of Saud. But the kingdom is not the only Sunni power to turn to proxies like Ahrar al-Sham in hopes of bolstering its influence in the region. Democracy is like a tram. You ride it until you arrive at your destination. Then you step off. So said Recep Tayyip Erdogan, then mayor of Istanbul in the mid-1990s. In his 11 years as prime minister of Turkey from 2003 to 2014, Erdogan sought to put that maxim into practice, striving to centralize as much power as possible in his own hands. Since moving to the presidency in August 2014, he has embarked upon a project whose aim is no less than the transformation of Turkish government from a parliamentary system into a presidential one, the executive presidency, as he has termed it. And there could be no more potent symbol of Erdogan's ambitions than the 1,000-room, $600 million white palace he has built in Ankara for himself and his successors. That is, should he ever decide to step aside and let someone else ride the democracy tram. Erdogan's staying power shows few signs of flagging. In July 2016, his government faced down an attempted military coup. Within days of the rebellion's failure, Erdogan had arrested or removed thousands of soldiers, judges, prosecutors, teachers, and academics. The crackdown was so sudden and so severe that one in three Turks believed the outlandish theory that the uprising had been staged by Erdogan himself in order to justify a further consolidation of his power. While there is no evidence that Erdogan was behind the coup, It certainly seems that he had a long list of opponents ready to be purged, should the opportunity arise. Erdogan combines his authoritarianism with a strong Islamist streak. His party, AKP, emerged from the Islamist Welfare Party, founded in the 1980s and long exiled from Turkish politics for its nakedly religious ideology. After 4 years as mayor of Istanbul, Erdogan served jail time for religious incitement, partly for reciting in public a poem that included the words, "The mosques are our barracks." The military banned Erdogan, as well as his former party, from Turkish politics, until AKP reversed that decision in 2003 and made him prime minister. Since then, he has presided over a full-scale revival in Islamist policies, pushing, among other measures, legislation to restrict the sale of alcohol and outlaw adultery. As he has grown more authoritarian domestically, Erdogan has become increasingly hawkish on the international scene. In 2009, he notoriously stormed out of a panel discussion in Davos after an angry exchange with Israel's then-president Shimon Peres. The following year, he backed a freedom flotilla to help ease the plight of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He has paired his growing independence of the United States and NATO with increasing hostility toward Israel and support for the pro-Islamist agenda championed by the Muslim Brotherhood. Erdogan threw his support enthusiastically behind Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood president, Mohamed Morsi, then became enraged when Morsi was overthrown and alienated Egypt's new president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, by accusing his regime of tyranny and state terrorism. But if Turkey is to live up to its president's international ambitions, it must have a card of some kind to play in the Syrian conflict. Only by influencing the course of events there will Turkey be able to check regional rivals like Iran and Saudi Arabia, tamp down Kurdish separatism in the south, and position itself to host a pipeline transporting natural gas from reserves under the Mediterranean to Eastern Europe and beyond. None of this is likely if Syria remains in the hands of a regime whose biggest allies are Iran and Russia. Like that of the other major Sunni power in the region, Saudi Arabia, Turkey's policy toward the Islamic State, IS, is complicated. On the one hand, Erdogan's government has allowed the United States to launch strikes against Islamic State positions from Incirlik Air Base, just over 100 miles from Aleppo, as the F-16 flies. In late 2015, Turkish forces even began training Iraqi Kurds, whose brethren in Turkey battle Ankara for independence, for operations to retake Mosul from IS. Indeed, Turkey has good reason to set itself against the Islamic State. IS has subjected Turkish cities to a campaign of suicide bombings that have killed scores of people. Yet Turkish officials have reportedly turned a blind eye to Sunni foreign fighters crossing into Syria, including those bound for the ranks of the Islamic State, even when they proffer obviously phony passports. Turkey's southern border has become known as the new jihadi highway, the entry point of choice for such fighters, avoiding more perilous routes across the desert or through Shia-controlled areas of Lebanon or Iraq. Just as significantly, Erdogan's government has tolerated cross-border shipments of stolen oil worth over $1 million a day, the Islamic State's main source of funds. Erdogan has openly backed opposition to Assad from groups sharing the Turkic ethnicity of a majority of Turks. It is no coincidence that the Russian plane, shot down by Turkish forces in November 2015, was in the area in order to bomb Turkic militants backed by Ankara. These groups bring another benefit to Ankara, in that they fight their Kurdish counterparts, staving off Turkey's recurring nightmare of a breakaway Kurdish state. Erdogan has also joined Saudi Arabia in supporting the al-Nusra and Arar al-Sham-led Army of Conquest, the Islamist coalition that has fought U.S.-backed groups and captured territory in northwest Syria. Indeed, Turkey's participation has been essential to ensuring that arms and supplies reach the group across the border. A Turkish official told the Associated Press that this support was intended to strengthen Arar al-Sham at the expense of al-Nusra, But it was not clear how this could possibly work, as the two groups were at the time close allies in the Army of Conquest. Indeed, some of their factions are even known to have spoken of a merger. In 2016, Erdogan began sending Turkish troops into Syria and Iraq, with the intention not of combating IS so much as dislodging the Kurdish factions in the region from control of territory along the Turkish border. But Erdogan's forces have found themselves fighting IS anyway, a reality brought home in brutal fashion in December 2016 with the release of a video showing IS executing Turkish soldiers by burning them alive. Erdogan's bellicosity on the international scene has come at a heavy price. When he first took the helm as prime minister, his avowed foreign policy was one of zero problems with the neighbors. Instead of force or heavy-handed tactics, he sought to exert influence in the region using soft power, based on cultural affinities and shared economic interests within the former sphere of influence of the Ottoman Empire. Today, as the foreign policy commentator Pyotr Zalewski points out, Turkey has gone from zero problems to zero friends. Erdogan has been forced to back down from his bellicosity toward Israel in order to secure Turkey's right to host part of a lucrative pipeline carrying Israeli natural gas to Eastern Europe. Shooting down the Russian plane over southern Turkey in November 2015 has turned out to be a catastrophic own goal. Not only did the strike fail to protect Turkish-backed Turkic fighters on the ground, it actually provoked Russia to step up its raids against those fighters. Erdogan, usually so careful to preserve his uncompromising image, has had to apologize to Vladimir Putin to head off threatened Russian economic sanctions that would have restricted access to Turkey's second-largest export market. The apology, in turn, infuriated the Islamic State, which regards Russia as one of its most formidable foes. IS expressed its outrage by attacking Istanbul Airport in June 2016 with suicide bombers who hailed from Russia and two former Soviet republics. 6 months later, in December 2016, a Turkish police officer turned Islamist assassinated the Russian ambassador in Ankara. It is significant that both attacks happened within days of high-level talks between Russia and Turkey about bringing an end to the conflict in Syria. Turkey's sole remaining friend in the region is Shia Iran. On Syria, to be sure, the two countries remain at odds. Erdogan is as vocal in demanding Assad's ouster as Iran is determined that he should stay. But on almost every other topic, Turkey and Iran now find themselves in agreement. In March 2016, the two countries emerged from talks in Tehran, agreeing to work together to stanch the bloodshed, as Iran's President Rouhani put it. Indeed, with U.S. and EU sanctions on Iran lifted, Turkish-Iranian trade is booming, and Turkey is bidding fair to become the conduit for future Iranian energy exports to Europe. It is above all in our own country's interest to strengthen our political dialogue and reduce our differences of opinion to a minimum, Erdogan said the following month after yet another high-level Turkish-Iranian meeting. We have to work together to overcome the problems of terrorism and sectarianism and the related humanitarian crises that are shaking our region. He has reportedly even stooped to helping Iran evade international sanctions. This newfound amity can only stoke Arab nervousness and may engender further poor policy decisions from Riyadh. And the more instability, the more state failure, the more regional confrontation, the more savagery, in al-Qaeda's terminology, the more this state of affairs will nourish groups like Ahrar al-Sham, the Islamic State, and al-Qaeda's own followers in Syria. Support from Turkey and Saudi Arabia has allowed groups like Ahrar al-Sham to prosper, even in the face of setbacks that might have destroyed other militant groups. In January 2014, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant killed one of Ahrar's senior commanders in Aleppo. The following month, Abu Khalid al-Suri himself died in a suicide bombing, most likely also perpetrated by ISIL, in circumstances which, as we shall see in the next chapter, say much about the constant infighting that has come to typify the Syrian insurgency. Then, in September of the same year, an even bigger disaster befell Ahrar al-Sham. Yet another bomb killed at least a dozen of its senior leaders. It was not clear who was responsible, but the act dealt the group a grievous blow. The dead included Hassan Aboud, Ahrar al-Sham's emir, and Abu Khalid's comrade-in-arms from their time in Sednaya prison together. Since that devastating attack, airstrikes have claimed the lives of yet more Ahrar commanders. In 2015, Ahrar's willingness to entertain political solutions and its reliance on Turkish support led to a falling out with al-Nusra. In early 2016, the dispute turned deadly, with the two groups clashing in Idlib province near the Turkish border. Despite these losses, Ahrar al-Sham has regrouped and battled on, helping to lead an Islamist capture of every town in Idlib province, apparently shooting down at least one Syrian Air Force jet. Ahrar was even able to overcome its differences with al-Nusra sufficiently to launch a fierce joint assault on regime forces near Abu Khalid's hometown of Aleppo, although the city would later fall to Assad's troops, backed by Russian aerial bombardment. Ahrar has shown itself adept at forming alliances with other rebel groups, no easy feat in a battleground as fractured as Syria. Ahrar's foreign relations spokesman has likened this process of coalition building to the dialogue, then neighborless, then coexistence, then coordination, then unification that characterized post-war Europe. In December 2012 and November 2013, it formed coalitions with smaller groups, arrangements that later led to mergers with eight of its allies. In March 2015, Ahrar subsumed yet another militia, the Sukkur al-Sham Brigades. The same month, it also became a charter member of the Army of Conquest, an alliance of Islamist groups supported by Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And yet, despite the efforts of the Islamic State, the various Islamist factions, and the secular opposition, the Assad regime still stands. Partly, that is, because of the opposition's well-documented failure to unite against him, a source of deep frustration for the West. But even more so, it is because he enjoys powerful regional backing of his own. On the battlefields of Syria and Iraq, one man has become ubiquitous. He can be seen standing on the hoods and flatbeds of trucks, surrounded by fighters who jostle and shush each other to hear and see better. His face lightly frosted with a close-cropped white beard, his dreamy eyes seeming to shine with the recollection of a fond memory. The man addresses his audience in a pillow-soft tenor. But this man is a soldier through and through. "When the war ends," he has said, "the honest mujahid clasps his hands sorrowfully. We lost, and the martyrs won." He is neither a Syrian nor an Iraqi, and he is certainly no Sunni foreign fighter. He is General Qasem Soleimani, supreme commander of Iran's elite Quds force. His rapt audiences are made up of Shia fighters nominally independent of the Quds force, but in reality, every bit as much under his command. Not only do these militants sing songs about Soleimani, one group even produced a viral music video of one of those songs featuring militiamen saluting the general's image. Soleimani hails from a small town in Kerman province, a tribal area of Iran's southeast. At the start of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, he joined the Revolutionary Guards and began his remarkable upward trajectory. In the 1980s, during the war with Saddam Hussein's Iraq, he led the Guards' 41st Division, nicknamed Thar Allah, Vengeance of God, one of the aliases of Imam Hussein, one of the key figures of Shia Islam, who was killed in Karbala, Iraq, in the year 680. By the end of 1997, he had become commander of the Quds Force, Iran's lethal special forces unit, initially formed to bolster pro-Iranian regimes abroad. Soleimani was chosen for the task partly because of his background in Kerman. which had long plagued the regime with ongoing tribal unrest. Within 3 years, Soleimani had pacified the province. At the same time, Soleimani was put in charge of managing relations with the upstart Taliban movement in neighboring Afghanistan. The general lent his country's support to the opposition Northern Alliance, but he also sought to calm tensions where necessary. When the Taliban executed 25,000 Shia in Mazar-i-Sharif, including a group of Iranian diplomats, factions on both sides were hot for war. Iran began massing forces along the Afghan border, but Soleimani stepped in and defused the situation without resort to further violence. Soleimani has been called the Shadow Commander, and with good reason. His influence can be felt throughout Iranian foreign policy, on which he has long enjoyed the unmediated ear of the Ayatollah Khamenei. During negotiations with the Americans in Baghdad in 2007, at the height of the U.S. counterinsurgency campaign, the Iranian ambassador to Iraq repeatedly excused himself to take orders via cell phone, not from his superiors in the foreign ministry, but directly from General Soleimani. The following year, Soleimani sent David Petraeus, then commander of coalition forces in Iraq, a message reading, "General Petraeus, you should be aware that I, Qasem Soleimani, control Iran's policy for Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and Afghanistan." Legend has it that the Americans' reply was to the effect, "General Soleimani, go pound sand down a rat hole." Few Iranians would dare be so impertinent to the shadow commander. At home, Soleimani has become a cult figure, as omnipresent on Iranian state television as he is in the Twitter feeds of Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. One Iranian filmmaker, accepting an award for his work, dedicated the trophy to Soleimani. Some Iranians have suggested that the general run for president, raising fears of a velvet coup by the military. But the place where Soleimani exerts the most feverish devotion remains the battlefield, where his tribal background and special forces training allow him to use sectarianism to military and political advantage. The general's centrality to the Syrian conflict reflects the Assad regime's decades-long relationship with Iran. During the Iran-Iraq War in the early 1980s, Hafez supported Tehran by shutting down a critical pipeline carrying oil exports out of Iraq. Later, Iran financed Syria's acquisition of a nuclear reactor and a clutch of Scud missiles from North Korea. And in 2003, Supreme Leader Khamenei responded positively to Assad's suggestion that the two regimes collaborate to make life difficult for the United States in Iraq. Today, Iran bankrolls Assad's war effort, providing an estimated $4 billion to $8 billion per year in grants, credits, and military hardware. Just as significantly, Iran has sent proxies and its own regular forces to Syria to fight for the government. Iran has a number of clear reasons to support Assad. First, there is the religious bond between Alawites and Shia. Iran, the world's most powerful Shia state, views itself as the Shia protector, and one of its main foreign policy goals is to establish a grand alliance of Shia-ruled countries, a category that, thanks to the removal of Saddam Hussein, now includes Iraq, alongside Syria and Lebanon. Secondly, Iran has economic reasons for cultivating Syria and Iraq as allies, not least the fact that it will need their cooperation if it is ever to build a planned overland pipeline to the Mediterranean from the giant South Pars North Dome gas field on the Persian Gulf. An Iran to Lebanon crescent, held together by faith and backed up by petrochemical power, would be a force to be reckoned with. But Iran's biggest concern is maintaining the supply corridor to its cat's paw in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Shipments directly into Lebanon are not an option because of Israel's naval and air patrols in the region, but thanks to their alliance with Assad, Iranian supply planes have carte blanche to land at Damascus International, where their deadly cargo is loaded onto trucks for transshipment over the mountains to Lebanon. Were the Syrian government to fall into the hands of the country's Sunni majority, which, as at the time of the French mandate, makes up around three-quarters of its population, those planes would be turned back, and Iran would be left without a card to play in the Middle East's most symbolically significant fight. Moreover, Hezbollah lies at the heart of Iran's wider goal of reclaiming a measure of its former hegemony in the region. With Iranian funds, training, and weaponry, Hezbollah enjoys tactical and intelligence capacity other factions can only dream of. In the early spring of 2014, for example, having tracked down the bomb makers responsible for suicide attacks in areas of Lebanon under its control, Hezbollah sent an undercover commando detachment deep into rebel-held Syria to find the house where several suspects were staying and reduce it to rubble with the targets inside. Such operations reveal a sophistication in planning and execution not unlike that of the Navy SEALs who took down Osama bin Laden. Hezbollah has undoubtedly changed the balance of the Syrian conflict. At the same time, and in part no doubt because of the sheer audacity of its operations, the group has suffered atrocious casualties in Syria. By the end of 2015, around a quarter of its personnel deployed in the conflict had been killed, representing about 10% of the group's entire fighting strength. General Soleimani makes a point of visiting the graves and families of the fallen. In January 2015, he was pictured reading the Quran alone at the flower-scattered tomb of a Hezbollah fighter, Jihad Mukhniya, son of the Hezbollah commander, Imad Mukhniya, who trained al-Qaeda members in Lebanon in the early 1990s. But Hezbollah is not the only group doing Soleimani's bidding in the region. In mid-2015, Iranian-backed militias from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, among other countries, were almost single-handedly fighting Sunni rebels for control of Syria's largest city, Aleppo, with practically no involvement from Assad's own forces. Over the border in Iraq, Iran funds and facilitates Shia militias collectively some 20,000 strong under the umbrella command of Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani's Revolutionary Guard has an active presence of its own in Syria. The Iranian regular and paramilitary forces he commands participate directly in combat, helping to prop up Syrian units plagued by defections. The Iranians have not held back from the thick of the fight, suffering an astronomical toll of casualties. Perhaps as many as 200 of the 2,000 personnel deployed have been reported killed, putting the death rate around three times that suffered by U.S. Marines in the Vietnam War. Among the dead have been several high-ranking commanders, including at least two Revolutionary Guard generals. But Iran's repeated demonstrations of its extraordinary commitment to Assad have purchased the Islamic Republic even greater leverage in Syria, the Middle East, and the wider world. From the perspective of a Sunni extremist, Iran's involvement in the Syrian conflict represents a clear and present military threat, but it also brings a propaganda windfall, as Zarqawi's incessant railings against rejectionists and apostates during the Iraq War amply demonstrated. Sectarian invective can be at least as effective a tool of terrorist recruitment as anti-Western messages. Both types of rhetoric play into the same persecution complex that al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have fostered, heightened, and exploited to such devastating effect. Moreover, the longer the conflict grinds on, the longer the savagery lasts, and the greater the opportunity for terrorist exploitation. From the embers of this regional catastrophe, extremist groups can look forward to a multifaceted bonanza. They gain the direct or indirect support of governments, like those of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, desperate to counter the influence of their adversaries. Massive refugee flows create deep pools of potential recruits, while the ready deployment of sectarianism as a tool of foreign policy helps radicalize those recruits and others from around the world. Meanwhile, instability and the resulting failure of central government creates zones of savagery ripe for exploitation. Bin Laden himself could not have imagined a more propitious set of circumstances for al-Qaeda.